Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culloden.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Culloden, where we explore business and economics from a wider perspective. So coming up this week, why the UK's productivity puzzle is back in the spotlight and what it means for jobs, pay and progress. Japan's first female prime minister is super popular and has called a snap election. But what is she offering to voters? And also, what can businesses expect from AI in 2026? Now, of course, if you'd like to get in touch, we would love to hear from you via email at takingstock@newstalk.com. Or, of course, you can find me on social media at Susan Hayes Culloden. Now, for my explainer this week, I wanted to focus on gold because given how much attention the gold price is getting, it is important to understand how people actually buy it. So in simple terms, you can either buy the metal itself, gold bars or coins, and that's also called gold bullion, or else you can buy a fund that tracks the gold price, and that's most often through an exchange traded fund or an ETF that you can trade through a broker. So naturally, the more people that are buying up either the metal or things like the ETFs that track it, that is what pushes up the price, and that is what has been happening since round about the turn of the century. So that's the one to watch. Now, Japan's increasingly popular most recent Prime Minister, Sene Takaichi, has called a snap election aiming to secure a mandate for major policy change. The election is set for February the 8th, and during her short premiership, Takaichi has become incredibly popular with the public, with a series of polls giving her public approval ratings as high as 75%, even as her Liberal Democratic Party remains unpopular. Joining me now to discuss why Japan's first female prime minister is so popular is Leo Lewis, Tokyo Bureau Chief at the Financial Times. Leo, first, let's get to grips with what's going on with the Japanese economy. I looked at the Bank of Japan's report that was out last week. They're predicting 1% real GDP growth and 1.9% inflation for 2026. And both are higher than what they estimated in October. You're on the ground over there. Bring us up to date on the economy first.
Yeah, so, you know, the Japanese economy, as we know, it's stagnant for many, many years.
Decades, in fact.
Yeah, and it came back into a situation really from the last 3 years where there's been inflation, there's been prices rising. And that has, you know, that's very different from the way it was in the past. At the same time, you know, the weak yen has made a lot of Japanese people not feel richer. So the economy may be growing, but people don't feel wealthy. They can't take holidays outside Japan, or don't feel they can afford holidays outside Japan. And Japan imports a huge amount of its food. And so you've had the weak yen feeding into the sense that prices of food, of cost of living has been going up and up and up. And that's really a bit of the background to this this election, that you do have a big chunk of what would probably consider itself middle class Japan, which just doesn't feel well off, even though, as you pointed out, the economy is in reasonably good health. And that's driven to a big extent by companies that are doing very, very well outside Japan. The weak yen is helping those companies do well, and that's feeding into those good numbers on the economy, or pretty encouraging numbers on the economy.
Well, as we have looked at the Japanese story, particularly in recent weeks, it's not just the Prime Minister has been gathering headlines, but also the debt. So this is a number I hadn't come across before, Leo. The government owes 1.3 quadrillion yen. It has net debt to GDP of 130%, and 90% of JGBs, which are Japanese government bonds, are domestically held. Or that means that Japanese people have been lending this money directly to the government. Now, in recent times, though, investors are demanding much higher interest rates when they lend to the Japanese government. Why is that?
So, you know, Japanese government bonds were not really moving. The yields on Japanese government bonds were not really moving for a long period of time. And a lot of that was because there was a deliberate policy of the central bank to control the yields, particularly on the 10-year. That's the sort of benchmark Japanese government bond. So that was under control. When the control was released a couple of years back, then things started to move, and they've started to move considerably quicker than I think a lot of people had guessed they would. And that's fed into concerns, not just the sort of long-term concerns. You know, how does Japan kind of pay for its own future with the population shrinking, the population getting older, and sort of these factors that we know about? But more recently, the concern has been that we're going to come on to this, but the politician Takaichi, who's now in charge, is going to start reopening the government spending taps as wide as she thinks they can go. And so the concern really is that if Japan is going to kind of spend its way back to a growth revival, which is what she wants, that just may strain things just a touch too far. And that's why we've seen these really pretty significant moves, not just over the last couple of weeks, but actually since she became prime minister 3 months ago. So it's really been quite dramatic on the Japanese debt markets.
And when we get more into what she stands for, I think that picture will become clearer. But first of all, will you tell us more about your Japanese Iron Lady, as she's called?
Yeah, so look, she has been on the political scene in one form or another for some time. She started her career in television. She was a presenter, pretty successful presenter. She went into politics, and she went into politics with a lot of vigor. You know, she went in, she studied out in the US, so she had a sense of what politics outside Japan looks like. And she latched herself onto the Shinzo Abe, who went on to be Japan's longest serving prime minister, and he was himself a very charismatic figure. She's obviously had to negotiate a political scene that is not very friendly to women. She doesn't come from a elite political family, which is what a lot of Japanese politicians in the Liberal Democratic Party do come from. You know, they're in some cases the sons or the grandsons of senior politicians, kind of dynasties, really. She's nothing like that. She's self-made. She came from the town of Nara and worked her way up through a couple of pretty senior cabinet jobs under previous administrations. And here she is now. She's tried to be prime minister a few times. She made it finally in October. And she is really a model of something that Japan values very highly indeed, which is determination and endurance. And so she is a sort of a representative, really, of some features of personality features that Japanese hold very dear.
That reference to the Iron Lady, of course, isn't anything to do with Margaret Thatcher. It's the fact that she was part of a heavy metal band, I believe.
She was part of a heavy metal band. She did drive around on a motorbike for quite a lot of...
She's very cool.
She is. And so the interesting thing is that she doesn't consider herself cool, that she considers herself, what a lot of people would see her as, which is a kind of conservative woman from middle Japan. But actually, the reality is that she is very interesting. And I think that's something that has really captured the imagination of the people that, the people that you were referring earlier to. The polls are showing her very, very popular. And what's perhaps most interesting about those polls has been how popular she has been with younger Japanese. That's a generation that hasn't been interested in politics for some time. And she is inspiring people. And that's a big difference. That's a really noticeable difference between now and a few years ago.
And this is why I'm intrigued to talk to you today, Leo, because right now, as people talk about her, they talk about the fact, like, that you've said, she's different, she's fresh, she doesn't come from a political dynasty, she's not a man. She believes in expansionary fiscal politics or economics and weaving that into the political scene. She's accessible. But the thing is, should she go on to win this election, it's fundamentally going to be her policies and how they're implemented are going to affect ordinary people on the ground. And that will be how her legacy will be written. But first of all, let's look at her to-do list, right? So she's got dealing with Trump, and she's been pretty successful at that. As you've already mentioned, a declining population and an aging population. In addition, of course, there's rising costs of living, which has affected much of the developed world, and tensions in the relationship with China. Now, people have said she has done well with the bad hand that she has been dealt. So how do you see this playing out? Should she win? How do you see this playing out in the months to come?
Well, it depends what you mean by winning. She is looking for a majority. Her party doesn't have a majority in Parliament at the moment. It runs the government through a coalition. If she emerges from this with a clear majority in Parliament, she can push through a number of policies that are her own and ones that she thinks are going to directly affect households. So one of those would be to reduce for a couple of years, to suspend, rather, the consumption tax on food. That's currently standing at 8%. And obviously, you take that away and that relieves the burden on a lot of Japanese households. More broadly, she wants to spend more on defence, and she wants to channel government spending into sectors of the economy that she thinks are where Japan most stands to grow. So high tech, AI, materials, highly specialised materials, and a few other areas where she thinks, look, Japan needs to focus its energies on these growth areas and use those to boost the overall economy and protect it really from its own future with that shrinking population.
And all of this sounds great for somebody who would be living in Japan, but I looked at her manifesto and she says, just as you said, she's looking for more stimulus, a stronger social security as well, but in addition, a reduction in the debt to GDP ratio. The only way she can achieve that is if the GDP rockets and the debt just either grows slower than GDP grows or else debt falls. I don't see how she can do the two.
No, and the conclusion that you've just reached there is pretty much the conclusion that financial markets are starting to move towards. And I think that is the difficulty here, which is that, you know, yes, it is true that the Japanese the Japanese tax revenues have been pretty good over the last year. There's, you know, the inflation that we've seen in Japan that is hurting those households is also pretty good for tax income. So that has been one following wind. She is talking about, well, look, within the G7, Japan is in pretty good shape. And so I think there is, you can see how it is that she's reached the conclusion that maybe they'll get away with it.
That sounds like a risky strategy, but time will tell, Leo. There's one last thing I want to ask you about, because this intrigues me about her, but it's certainly one that's also garnering a lot of attention. She believes in work, 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 work and work. I think I got that in the right order. Whereby, at the moment, Japan's working hour regulations typically restrict overtime to 45 hours a month and 360 hours a year. But yet, and I got this from the Labour Ministry data, Japanese workers depend on overtime pay for roughly 6% of their annual income. Do you think the whole emphasis on work-life balance recently in Japan would change under this administration should it come to pass?
It's a very good question. I mean, obviously, work-life balance has been a kind of big preoccupation for a series of administrations long before Takeuchi was prime minister. One of the concerns has been that if work-life balance continues the way it has, that, you know, that there won't be young couples won't be forming families, that birth rate will continue to be extremely low, and that just feeds into yet more problems for the economy in the longer term. When she said that, I think that when she used her sort of work, work, work comment, and people said, well, look, does she mean everyone in Japan needs to work a lot harder? I think what she was trying to do was to show that she planned to lead by example. And it's not just about, you know, how many hours work she puts in. What she's talking about is she thinks that, you know, fundamentally, she thinks that Japan needs to be energized again, energized with an idea that there is something worth fighting for. And I think that for a lot of Japanese around her age, sort of in their 60s, there's a recollection of how vibrant Japan was in the 80s, how it lost that in the 90s, and it's always looking for a kind of formula for how you revive that. And I think that what she was saying there was, let's try and revive that spirit of vigor that has been lost to Japan for so long. And I think that was what was going on there. And I think that what she's planning to do is not, you know, just turn everyone back into kind of that image that people had of Japanese as working themselves to death. I think what she means is, let's re-find our kind of national purpose and our reason for getting up in the morning. I think that's what is going on there. It remains to be seen whether the general public will buy into that narrative. But I think that's what she's doing.
Well, all eyes will be on Japan on the 8th of February. And it was intriguing to talk to you, Leo. Thank you indeed, so much indeed, for joining me here and Taking Stock. Leo Lewis, Tokyo Bureau Chief at the Financial Times.
Thank you so much.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, what AI trends are set to define 2026? Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. And now for my trivia this week. I was in a 19th century castle built by the county's earls in the 1830s in the county in Ireland with the lowest population. The question is, where was I? Have a think about it and I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, well, if 2025 was the breakout year for AI, will 2026 be a year when companies really embrace the potential of AI? I'm delighted to be joined by Robert Byrne, technology, data and AI partner from PwC Ireland. Now, Robert, I read the piece that has come out from PwC all about this, and the very first statement jumps out at me, which is only a few companies are realising extraordinary value from AI, such as surging growth and valuation premiums. Many others see return on investment, but results are modest. So tell us, what is the state of play at the moment with companies and their engagement with AI?
Yeah, Susan, firstly, thanks for having me on. I think what we're seeing with clients and through our research is that companies are taking... Companies, they certainly see the potential in AI, but I think they're also taking, particularly in Ireland, taking quite a cautious and moderate approach in relation to the AI projects that they undertake and the extent of the number of projects that they have, the number of projects that they start, and I suppose the ambition that they have for those particular projects.
So is there a difference, though, between companies who are looking at AI from the perspective of productivity boosting, saving costs, saving time, and those who are trying to make money out of it in terms of maybe new products or so on that they are producing?
Yeah, look, there's definitely a divide that we see between companies that are more ambitious than others. I don't think that's necessarily a definition of the companies that are undertaking their AI projects. I think it's a factor of where they are at in their AI journey. The vast majority of companies that we see and we work with tend to start their AI journey at quite a with a modest level of ambition. They might run a few pilots. They tend to run them on areas more so in the back office than the front office while they find their feet, develop some capability, generate some benefits. And they tend to run them against use cases that are probably have one particular outcome and tends to be around cost reduction and efficiency gains. The more ambitious and the more progressive organizations that we see and work with tend to have a wider vision for AI. They are not afraid to look at use cases in the back office and the front office. Typically, the use cases that they look at have multiple benefits. So they're not just looking for cost reduction. They're looking for revenue growth, improving customer experience, reducing risk. And I think when you combine all those benefits together, what they look at is they tend to look at whole sections of their business and say, is there a process there or a service there that we can transform using AI, a combination of AI and process change? What we see and what we hear continually is those companies that when they do that, they get a multiplier effect in terms of the benefits that they yield. And that's very much where we would be advising companies on their AI journeys to aim for.
So when you say back office versus front office, do you mean back office would be how the business is run, front office is client facing?
Yeah, it's a loose term, but what I'd really be referring to there is areas like maybe finance, HR, procurement, and then in front office, anywhere facing off against the customer, sales, production and so on.
Well, I'm very much in that camp myself, Robert. Okay. So I'll give you a quick story about things that I've been telling Taking Stock listeners about. So we have a project management system, and because we use it all the time and all of our interactions with it in terms of email and everything else, understandably, we've now developed a large language model out of it because basically that's there. So in the past couple of days, I built an agent in there which said, come into all my meetings with me, transcribe the meeting, run a summary, draft an email, create a task with subtasks and assign those to the various members of staff, and then ask me to check before anything goes out. Sure. And I did that. Now, I can't code, but because the project management system that we have allows me to build these with a prompt, so it's an AI helping me to create an AI.
Yeah.
That is my understanding of agentic AI, and I've done that for multiple things based on, as you say, use cases. But to go back to your point, all of those are back office.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the type of use case you're hearing, where people are looking for ways to maximise the use of what they've got, or are there other areas that companies are coming to you with?
I think it's a really good example, and it's a very good example as well of using agents for personal productivity.
Exactly, exactly.
And that's what
gives me back time.
Yeah, it gives you back time. Mm-hmm. And that's probably a very common starting point for organizations on their AI journey. Typically, they want their people to get familiar, comfortable, and get benefit from their AI investments. Then typically what you might see is agents being built that are used by more than one person. So I'll give you an example. I said back office. In the finance function, for example, instead of somebody spending their time processing invoices, okay, build an agent that can take your invoices, scan them, take the information from them, triangulate the is the data correct with your receipt and your purchase order, and if so, send for payment. So that's an agent that can be used by multiple people, not just you, for your own productivity. That might be the next stage of maturity, where you're building agents that are used for more than one person in a particular department, and then that frees up time in that department for the people who previously would have spent, I don't know, say 2 days a month processing invoices, to focus on higher value activities.
And yet, Robert, if you and I had spoken, I'm going to say a month ago, I would have said agentic AI, don't like it yet. I don't like the idea that it could interact across multiple systems, or that it could be client facing. And I was wrong, because you can build an agent like we're discussing here simply internally, simply using your own systems, where a client never has to see it. So do you think that there's a fear out there? And I'm speaking on behalf personally here. There's a fear around engaging with agentic AI because we think it's something different than what it is?
There's a few layers to it. I think there may be a reluctance to build agents that are too ambitious in the first instance.
Yes, I can see the why.
I think that for a number of reasons, like, companies have worked so hard to build and establish trust in their customers that they're going to protect and use their data in the correct way. And I think it's a very powerful technology. There's tons of potential with it. We know there's any amount of use cases and any amount of the potential for agents to transform a business. But with that power, if you like, there's also a responsibility on companies to make sure that they use it in an appropriate way. And I think the nervousness that you refer to is probably, it's understandable at the start, but if you want to get most benefit from it, you have to get past the nervousness that you might have in relation to it, put in place proper structures and controls to have responsible AI in place in your organization, deploy that at scale so that everyone has an understanding of what to do to make sure that the AI agents in this case that get deployed are done so in a secure, safe, ethical, legal manner that doesn't put you offside with any one of a number of stakeholders that you need to make sure are listened to.
And on top of all of that, one of the biggest barriers to, and I'm particularly referring back here to your point about the where you see 2026 going. You said 25 was a breakout year, 26 is when companies really embrace the potential.
Yeah.
Isn't the difference between the two actually staff engaging with it? Isn't there a whole behavioural change element to this, which is we can have all this technology and point out the benefits, but yet people do what they do. Sometimes people do what they've always done. How do you find engaging with companies who are saying, listen, we have all this great potential, it's just people don't use it because they're just not in the habit of it yet?
There's a few layers to it. Okay, I think the people dimension of AI is enormous. Okay, and I think if you try and match up the potential that AI offers with the amount of change management that is needed to bring your people on that journey with you, you won't go too far wrong.
And I think that's what people are underestimating, Robert, is there is a lot of change management that needs to go with it.
There's an enormous amount. Mm-hmm. And there's also, people don't yet, because we know that the adoption of agentic AI in particular in Ireland is low compared to global peers, people don't yet have a full appreciation of the level of change and the level of benefit that agentic AI in particular can bring to their organization. And if you match that off with then, if they don't know the level of change or the level of benefit, they also don't have an appreciation of the extent of the change that is going to happen in their organization off the back of this. We did a survey recently. Two-thirds of our respondents said that agentic AI is going to have a more transformative effect on their workplace than the internet.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
So if you think about that and you go, okay, so what level of change management do you need to put in place to make sure that your people are skilled, that you have the right, your workforce is the right shape and size and skills composition, number one. And then number two, for the people in your organization, what have you done to bring them on the journey? Have you communicated sufficiently with them? Have you done regular feedback loops with them? Have you trained them sufficiently? Have you done all of these things to make sure that they understand and they accept and they adopt what will be permanently new ways of working when they have ways of working that require people and AI agents to work together when previously it was mostly just people?
And there is so much there in what you're saying about people don't realise the impact it can have. I mean, that statistic that you say there is huge, to think that it could have a bigger impact than the internet. But I too was one of those people, I would say, a month ago, because I didn't try it out. I didn't know the use cases that I could apply, and I didn't know how quickly we could do it. The other thing that I think is different about having an agent versus simply talking to a traditional AI is, as I was talking to the agent now, just in case listeners are thinking that I was talking out loud, as in I was typing to the agent, I was training it how I wanted it to work, and it remembers. So therefore, the agent basically is a form of digital labor now that is in place. But I want to pick up on an area you pointed out, because some people could be listening to this and saying, whoa, 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 whoa. Is it too late now to be putting the genie back in the bottle here? One of the areas that you say we really need to focus on in 2026 is responsible AI.
Yeah.
Do you mean that the AI is responsible for what it's doing? Is it an environmental concern, or is it the concern that people are now saying, well, look, are my skill sets going to be relevant in a couple of years' time? What does responsible AI mean in 2026?
As a term, it's a very broad church, okay? And if I could summarise it, I'd say it's the set of governance, controls, procedures, policies, etc. that you put in place to make sure that your AI systems are developed and run in a way that's ethical, that's fair, that's legal, that's compliant with regulation. If you think about that, that can mean a lot of things. Is, do you have the right cyber controls in? Are you protecting the information? Are you using, is your AI solutions, and are you using AI in an ethical manner? We've got no shortage of examples in the press recently of where AI hasn't been used in an ethical manner. I don't need to go into specific cases, but that's a very good example of when responsible AI hasn't been properly applied.
And there is so much to consider. It's a fascinating topic, and I think you're right. 2026 could well be the year when companies embrace the potential in AI. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Robert. Thanks so much indeed for joining me. Robert Byrne, Technology, Data and AI Partner at PwC Ireland.
Thank you, Susan.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. Up next, why small business challenges could be good for the bigger economy in the UK. Now, a new report out in the UK has highlighted that in the years since COVID, the economy has delivered the same growth that would previously have been expected in about 7 months. However, Soumaya Keynes, economics columnist at the Financial Times, suggests that perhaps the answer to this is clearing out zombie companies. Soumaya joins me now to explore this tough love. Now, Soumaya, the report says weak productivity growth is the main reason that incomes have risen so slowly. So what's holding back UK productivity?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting trend. So if you look at not just the last 2 years, but the last 20 years, what's been happening is the level of dynamism in the UK economy has been falling, right? So if you think about the economy as, you know, lots of stuff happening, people moving to better jobs, better companies growing, worse companies shrinking, the rate at which that reallocation has happened has just been slowing for quite a long time. And so the worry is that this is leaving a bunch of not great companies sort of surviving, but not allowing the economy to thrive.
And why do you think this is particularly prominent in the UK? Because we could look at other parts, particularly of the developed world, and potentially point out the same, but it seems to be entrenched in the UK. What's different?
Yeah, I mean, this is the trillion-dollar question. I mean, you do see these dissimilar sort of decline in dynamism across other rich countries. So there are some trends that it could be something to do with the nature of the move to digital services. Manufacturing has just become smaller. The way that the economy is changing in permanent ways that's common to all economies. There's a sort of separate, question about whether the UK has made it hard for good companies to grow, right? Is it something about, say, planning permission? Is it super hard to build and that constrains the biggest, best companies from growing? And that means that they don't pinch workers from the less productive company. So that's one theory, that it's maybe something to do with regulations around land and building. And of course, in Ireland, you guys know something about that as well.
We do. We certainly do. I was a little bit surprised at one of the lines in the report, and you picked up on it on a piece that you've written recently in the Financial Times. I'm going to quote it directly. It says, "Our hunch is that the triple whammy of multi-year increases in interest rates, energy prices and the minimum wage is finally beginning to finish off some of the low productivity zombie firms that managed to stay afloat." The reason I was surprised there, Soumaya, is ordinarily government and society tends to be sympathetic towards the plight of small business. But this report suggests these challenges could be the answer to a national problem.
Yeah, and I mean, it's worth really emphasising that this process of creative destruction of struggling companies going out of business is horrible, right? It's horrible for the people who lose their jobs. It's horrible for the business owners who can't make their business work anymore. It's a really horrible part of, capitalism. And I guess the report was saying, well, we need something to speed up this process again, right? We need something to make those smaller, less productive companies die out. Now, I'm actually a little skeptical that those external forces are the answer, right? And one reason is that if you believe that, then, maybe recessions should be really great because, they kill lots of companies. Maybe it would be the ones that were struggling most. But you don't actually see that, right? You see that, yes, in recessions, what happens is because of these, awful dynamics, companies do lay off a lot of workers and struggling companies do go bust. But what happens in the aftermath is everyone just hangs on, right? Everyone freezes in place because it's so awful, right? And so the concern now is that, yes, we may have these really difficult things going on in the economy, but if companies aren't, confident about the outlook, then maybe they're just going to freeze in place, right? And we're not going to get the kind of positive growth that we really need to make things better.
This is where sometimes I find economics can be a hard, and I mean that literally, a hard science, because it can be very tough societally or personally to take the lessons that the economic diagnosis can dish out. And that certainly is an example of it here. That said, there has been some embryonic developments in terms of the productivity growth in the UK, and it pointed out a turnaround over the past year because the number of people working to produce the output of the UK has been falling. Now, you've already alluded to this in the first answer you gave me, but is this down to AI and other technology, or do you think the recent, very, very recent increase in UK productivity is coming from somewhere else?
So I'm a little bit skeptical that we are already seeing, AI clearing out jobs and making us all super productive. I think in terms of the take-up rate, it's still a bit early to say. I mean, thinking about, the dynamics in the UK, to the extent that there has been this uptick in productivity, the worry is that actually that's been driven by fewer people working. The people who are working managing to produce a huge amount of more stuff. Right?
And so it's so, actually a growing unemployment rate in the UK is the reason behind this, as distinct to the same amount of people working, using AI and delivering more.
Exactly. That's the fear that seems to be going on in the data. Right now, we've seen a bit of destruction. We've seen some companies going out of business. We've seen, the labor market isn't looking that great. So we've seen the kind of the bad bit of the destruction. What we haven't seen yet is this huge surge in, you know, companies creating new jobs, expanding, you know, new businesses opening up. And we really need to see that to feel really optimistic about the future of AI and just the future of the economy, I think.
Well, I'm going to shift away from the report now and on to the piece that you wrote, because I thought you landed at something really interesting that deserves more attention than it gets. I'm just going to quote you first. You said, there's also no guarantee that employment shifts across sectors move people towards higher productivity work. So let me simplify this. If productivity improves, then public and private sector employers can achieve more with less, so they may not need as many people. So therefore, Soumaya, I put this question to you. To whom does higher productivity pay?
Wow, okay, that's a big question. Mm-hmm. So I think the point that you're highlighting, I think, is about how you get this higher productivity, right? What you could get is people moving from unproductive, less productive sectors as they're measured in the national statistics, and there's a whole other question about how well they're measured, right? So you could get people moving from that to the higher productivity sectors, right? So, you know, maybe people move away from, you know, food manufacturing and towards, you know, software coding or what have you.
Which would be a big jump, but that would be a big jump to go from a factory line producing food into being able to code software. But if one was to do that, as you say, then that would possibly be moving into a higher productive sector.
Yes, possibly, right? But that's not actually historically how we have become more productive, right? It's not people moving between sectors. It's actually within the sector. It's people moving from, a badly managed, badly run restaurant to a really well-managed, really well-run restaurant. It's actually the changes within the sector, people moving to that better job within the sector that really delivers the higher productivity growth, right? And so in terms of who gets the gains in productivity, it's kind of people moving up the ladder within their sector, you know, so I suppose don't worry if people aren't jumping from, say, food manufacturing to become coders. It's okay if people are able to move to better run companies that are able to expand because they're just fantastic businesses. That's really the thing that we're looking out for.
Now, what I'm hearing you say is that while a company or a government might see higher productivity, what a person needs to see is they're doing higher value work, which translates into a higher salary, which translates into a better lifestyle for them.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, I thought it was very interesting as well how you explored the industry dimension, because we talked there about changing sectors, like, say, from food manufacturing into coding. But you also point out that turnover per employee is about 17 times higher in the top decile of construction companies than in the bottom decile, which is the same sector but different companies. What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, there's just absolutely enormous differences in turnover per employee within sectors, right? The gap between the most, the highest revenue, most productive construction company and the least productive construction company is just absolutely enormous, right? Which really underlines this point. Like, if you can move people from the bottom of that distribution to the top, there are huge gains on the table, right? There are a lot of just very, poorly managed companies out there, and a lot of really well-managed companies. And if people could just move to those better managed ones within those sectors, that would be great.
If this was a business show, Soumaya, I would love to ask you what the secret is to do that. But of course, we need to stay focused on the area of economics. And so I also wanted to understand the trend of jobs moving between sectors or within sectors, because that, as you say, is what makes the difference. And this partly is the government's job. Okay, understandably, if I want to move up the value chain, let's say, it's up to me to retrain and invest in myself and upskill and so on. But of course, the government also needs to be able to do that at a national level. And certainly here in Ireland, like 20 years ago, when our construction industry collapsed, there was a big drive to retrain a whole cohort of our economy. How is this playing out in the UK? Do you think if somebody wanted to change sectors or progress themselves within their own, that there is support out there to do that?
I mean, there's probably not the optimal amount. It is hard. I mean, one thing we have seen is that the rate of job switching over that 20-year period has fallen, right? There's something that's making people more reluctant to switch jobs. Now, whether that's because they don't have the skills to move to a job, I know in the US there's this huge issue of non-compete clauses in contracts. They're not allowed to move to a competitor, which could slow things down. So the government has a huge role in helping people to move. And I suppose what I don't think has happened, I don't think the government has become worse, right, at providing that support. So we've seen this long-run decline in the rate at which people are switching between industries, but I don't think that's because of a decline in government support. I think there's probably something else going on in the structure of the economy, in the kind of conditions that we're facing, that is behind that trend.
I find the UK economy so interesting to look at from many perspectives, but that's one, is what is going on there. I mean, as I look at overall trends of what's going on across the water here, I see obviously a big decline in immigration, and that has a knock-on effect in the labour markets. But also I see the UK lags international peers on employment among the under 25s and the over 50s. What else do you think is contributing to a change in the fundamental structure of the labour force in the economy today, Soumaya?
Well, I mean, you know, there's the age-old issue of you know, demographic, people getting older. There are state pension changes, which should actually move in the opposite direction. I mean, just to kind of, I suppose, give a kind of a big picture factor that would contribute to sort of general slowing demand, a reduction in the dynamism of the UK economy that would create fewer opportunities for those people would be Brexit, right? Mm-hmm. We've, you know, as a country, thrown up huge trade barriers with our, you know, our closest and biggest trading partners. Economically, not a good idea.
You're preaching to the converted on that case, believe me.
And you can see it, you know, you can see it in the data compared to our peers who didn't do that. The UK economy just hasn't been performing as well, right? Companies that would have had access to that massive, massive market now find it harder to access it, right? And so, you know, where would you expect that to show up? You know, maybe in declining labour market opportunities for people.
And the one thing I do have to ask you in a conversation around productivity is the, going back to your own phrase, the age-old challenge with, we can measure productivity, let's say, if we're talking about output, like things. The more things that a company makes, well, then it's easier to evaluate that. But when it comes to the caring industries, like, let's say, somebody working in a nursing home or in education, how, as an economist, and specifically as an economics columnist, can you help us understand how to evaluate productivity when you can't measure the things that they are producing?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really difficult. And really what, you know, what the statistics agencies are trying to do is they're trying to look at outputs and they're trying to look at inputs, right? And so, you know, how many hours are people spending caring for people? Like, how much does that cost? What you really want to do is get a sense of how the quality of that care has changed. And then what's almost impossible to do is observe how the needs of people are changing, right? You want to have all of those things and use that in your assessment of, you know, what's happened to productivity. Because when you look at the official numbers, productivity in the adult social care sector has been falling over the last 20 years. It looks like we've been getting worse at caring for people, which doesn't really make sense, right? Or it does if you think that there might be something going on that needs are getting more complex. And so it's become more difficult to provide that care.
It's really interesting to talk to you, Soumaya Keynes, economics columnist at the Financial Times. Really interesting to talk to you about this because there are so many different consequences to each and every single one of the points that you brought up. So thanks so much indeed for joining us today on Taking Stock.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a real treat.
Now, for the answer to my trivia this week. So here's the question that I posed to you earlier on in the show. This week, I was in a 19th century castle built by the county's earls in the 1830s in the county in Ireland with the lowest population. Where was I? The answer is I was actually in Lochrinn Castle in County Leitrim. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast, first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And I already look forward to chatting to you again next week.